This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. It is the 8th of March, International Women's Day. It's a Friday. Here's what we've got for you today. Well, we are going to be focusing on International Women's Day a little bit later on in the podcast. Conversation with Heather Henyon, who is the founding partner of the investment firm Mindshift Capital. They've been analysing just how much, or indeed how little, venture capital funding goes to companies that were founded by all women teams. Less than 0.5% in the Middle East and North Africa. It's bad globally. It's worse here. Heather Henyon has all the details. What else can I tell you? Well, we're going to be talking about tax. Story broke overnight, Thursday night, Friday morning, about Dubai introducing a new 20% tax on international banks. And we thought, whoa, that's a big deal. It's not such a big deal. Don't panic. Don't worry, because it's a new law, but not a new tax, according to our guest, Thomas Van Hee of Orifer, the tax consultancy. We'll hear from him. What else? Alan Smith, always love speaking to him, CEO of the food company Agthea, best known for brands like Alain Water. He's been talking about their full year results and what is going to happen to sales of dates in the holy month of Ramadan. Spoiler, they are going to increase significantly. And finally, talking economics, we've heard over the past 24 hours from Christine Lagarde, the head of the European Central Bank. She kept interest rates on hold, but everybody was looking at her commentary in the press conference afterwards. We'll hear from Ms. Lagarde and reaction from Dr. Stefan Gerlich. He's chief economist at EFG Bank. He's formerly deputy governor of the Bank of Ireland, so he's a European policymaker. His thoughts on Christine Lagarde and the European Central Bank. All that to come on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast.
We've got some new tax legislation to discuss this morning when it comes to banks. Very pleased to be joined by Thomas Van Hee, the founding partner of Orifer, on the line this morning to talk us through the basics of it. Morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Brandy. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the obvious question. What's changed?
Well, you're probably going to be the only news outlet that got this right. This is a new law, but not a new tax.
Explain to me then what's new about the law if the tax itself is not.
Yes. So I think people get a bit jumpy when it comes to new taxes sometimes. So what has changed is in the 1996 Dubai law, so local Emirates law, did not cater for any federal corporate income tax, because obviously in 1996 there was no corporate income tax. Banks, which were operating outside of the DIFC in mainland Dubai, found themselves in a situation where they were paying 20% corporate tax on profit to the Emirate of Dubai and 9% federal corporate income tax. What has changed in this legislation is now that the federal corporate income tax is creditable against the 20% corporate income tax.
Okay, so are banks effectively saving here?
Banks are saving compared to a situation where they would be paying 20 and 9% indeed.
It doesn't apply to entities in the DIFC. Is that anyone who's registered in the DIFC, or is it just those that have customers within, earn their income within but not without? Talk to me about how the free zone works with this.
Yes. Obviously, the DIFC is a heavily regulated financial free zone. If you're regulated in the free zone, you're not supposed to conduct any business in the mainland. So if you are not conducting any business in the mainland, then you don't fall inside the scope of this 20% corporate tax for the Emirate of Dubai. You simply fall back onto the regime which is applicable in the DIFC, which is then again the federal corporate income tax regime. So you might not be taxable if you're operating in the DIFC, if you earn qualifying income, and if the only income that you earn is through an activity conducted from within the DIFC.
There's penalties here, up to 50,000 dirhams for non-compliance. What would non-compliance look like in this case?
Non-compliance would be filing an incorrect return, filing a late return. Those would be the elements of non-compliance. And that is, by the way, the second element of this law, which is different compared to the 1996 law. So those are only really the two elements which have been updated.
Before we let you go, Thomas, what's the bigger picture here? What are the potential knock-on effects?
Obviously, the banks, they already knew that they were going to be subject to 20% and 9%. This reduces the overall net tax bill. So this is good news for the banks. Whether that's going to have a knock-on effect on consumers or not really depends quite a bit, because remind you as well that this tax is only applicable to foreign banks licensed in the Emirate of Dubai. So it does not apply to a purely local bank.
What's the situation for a local bank then?
A local bank is simply subject to the federal corporate income tax, but is not subject to this local banking tax of 20% in the Emirate of Dubai. So there is a difference there in terms of the net tax liability of the two types of banks.
Thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. I know you're travelling. I know you're in Saudi. We appreciate your time. Thomas Van Hee is founding partner at the tax advisory Orifa, speaking to us about that change to Dubai banking tax legislation.
So the message I'm getting there is don't panic. If you're opening the papers this morning and looking at the headlines or listening to the radio, yes, technically new Dubai 20% tax on foreign banks, but it isn't a new tax. This is the legislation catching up with the reality. No one's levying extra taxes. Am I right in drawing that conclusion?
I'm giving you the... I told Thomas to break it down for me this morning. He gave me one line, and his line was, law is new, tax is not.
Very good. And breathe.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Talking, as Richard said there, about the food business and a couple of things impacting on it at the moment. Egthia, massive food player, releasing its 2023 numbers. Very pleased to be joined in the studio by the CEO, Alan Smith. Alan, it's lovely to see you.
Good morning.
Okay, let's talk growth first up. Revenue up 12%. Where's that growth coming from?
Look, I think it's coming across our business. If you think our highest performing business is our snacking portfolio, but I think all of our verticals have done very well last year. And I think if you think about the results within the scope of the economic challenges last year, growing revenue, growing profit faster than revenue, growing EBITDA as well very healthily. So we're very pleased with the overall performance of the business.
Yeah, let's talk about the profitability, so efficiencies and margins and the like there. The underlying group net profit, and we've got a couple of net profit numbers because corporate tax has changed things a little bit when companies do their accounting, coming in at over 25%. Where are you seeing those efficiencies and that profit?
Look, there's a couple of things. Obviously, the what we call the mix in the business. So the fact that our snacking portfolio is growing faster than the rest of the business is helping the overall profitability.
Are the margins higher on snacks?
Yeah, so the margins are typically higher on the snacking portfolio because we're selling value add, we're selling dates, we're selling healthy snack bars. So, you know, typically the margins of our snacking portfolio are better than the margins of the rest of the business. But actually, we've expanded margins across all the portfolio. So mix is part of it. You mentioned efficiencies. We drove around 3% net productivity in the business last year, so that's around 100 million dirhams. That all adds to the bottom line in terms of how the business is performing.
Very quickly, how are you getting more productive?
That's a great question. Look, I think one of the key factors in our business performance is volume growth. So if you look at our growth last year, out of the 12% volume growth, out of the 12% revenue growth, 8% came from volume. And, you know, for companies who are in the manufacturing industry, putting more volume through your assets obviously gives you more productive output. You look at how you, the packaging in your portfolio, you look at formulations, you look at how do you optimize your route to market? So there's a lot of different levers you can pull to improve your profitability or your productivity in the business.
You've mentioned snacking. We've been talking about Novo Nordisk, the drug maker, this morning. Obviously, Ozempic has been an absolute game changer for the health industry. What does it mean for you? Are you having discussions about the Ozempic effect potentially on sales?
Not really. I think the Ozempic effect just gives you an indication. Something that we are seeing in the industry is a much greater focus by consumers on what they're consuming and their health. So when we talk about snacking, a lot of our portfolio is driven by healthy snacking. So consumers very conscious about, you know, how they use the products, what they consume, what the origin of the products is, and whether they're natural. So we think our portfolio is very geared up for that. So I think it's a general consumer trend.
One of the things that FMCG companies in the US have been talking about is potentially smaller packaging if people are just eating less as a result of some of these weight loss drugs?
Look, I think portion control is always important. And I think when you think about consumption of anything, it's all about a balanced diet. So, you know, across our portfolio, we have healthy snacking. We also have indulgent snacking. And, you know, I like to think that, you know, chocolate always helps us feel better. So it's not just about physical health. It's also about mental health. So having the right portfolio, consuming in moderation is always going to be key to a healthy diet.
Let's talk about dates. Ramadan is upon us. You've been investing in, and I quote, date innovation.
We have been investing in date innovation. I think, you know, just getting to that, back to that topic of healthy foods, dates is, in, you know, many people's eyes, a superfood. And if you look across the industry today, many of our peers are using dates as a replacement for sugar in the manufacture of their products. From our perspective, it's a very important business. You know, we have the biggest dates processing facility in the world here in the UAE. And business growth, we've expanded. We're now selling dates to over 60 countries around the world. So this business continues to be a key part of our growth story.
Is there more potential for you to sell date as a sugar to other companies, as an ingredient?
Look, we look at it, the way we look at our innovation in dates is, you know, product innovation, so what people consume as a date, dates with inserts in them. We enrobe dates, so chocolate dates, but we also look at how we can develop that ingredient business as well and how we can sell business, whether it comes in date syrup, date paste, or even in the form of date powder.
What will Ramadan mean for your date business? Typically, what kind of percentage and spike in sales?
Look, dates is an interesting category because it's very seasonal. So we start to see the harvest starting from August, and typically it finishes around November. So quarter four and quarter one are always a big period for us. But as you point out, the consumption very much comes in Ramadan. So typically, we would expect to see a 20, 30% uplift in our sales during this time of year. And one thing we've focused a lot on is not just the dates we sell from the UAE, but sourcing dates from the whole region to give much more variety to our consumers.
One of the things we always love discussing with you when we go through your numbers is water. It's a really great proxy for population because it's basically commoditized. When we look at the UAE, what did you see in water sales in 2023?
So if we look at it, our water business performed very well last year. 4% of that came from volume, 2% of that came from pricing. But even on the pricing side, it came more from what we call mix. So consumers buying more premium products. So whether that's sparkling water, whether that's glass bottled water, whether that's fortified water. So we've seen some growth in that space. But yeah, overall, the UAE economy and the consumption patterns are very healthy at the moment.
So if you were to give me one number for, and we've got a couple of bottles of Alain water behind us in the green room, that's your standard water, isn't it? If you were to give me one number that gave us an idea of what's happening in terms of the amount of people who are drinking it here in the UAE, what would that number be?
I would say the volume growth. So 4% volume growth gives you a good idea of how much consumption is going through in the market. I would say that that's probably a good proxy to what the population's doing.
Let's finish up talking about some of the things you'll be doing this year. I've got a minute and a half left with you. M&A, are you looking?
We're always looking. So, you know, our stated growth strategy has always been quite clear. We're driving our businesses, the acquired businesses, very hard, though. So if you look at last year, 30% of our growth actually came from innovation on our existing businesses. We continue to look at opportunities. If you look at our balance sheet on the business, we're in a very nice position. We paid down nearly 800 million dirhams of debt last year, which means we're in a good position to look at potential opportunities. But we need to make sure they're right. We need to make sure that they add, they're accretive to the business, gives more value to our shareholders. So, yeah, we're continuing to look at opportunities. And if the right one's there, hopefully we'll be able to move forward.
What are you missing from the portfolio?
No, we're very happy with the portfolio. So I think when we look strategically at what we have, we are very clear on our strategy that was to focus on four verticals. We have those four verticals. It's roughly 25% of the business for each of the verticals. 50% of our revenue now comes from international markets. So we're not looking for anything additional. We're looking to build on what we already have.
CEO of Agthia, Alan Smith, speaking to us this morning. With their 2023 numbers, a 12% growth in revenue, a more than 25% growth in underlying net profit. And as he said there, if we look at their basic entry level water as a proxy number, and you know how much we love to do that, 4% growth in 2023. We appreciate you playing that game as well, Alan.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right then, big day yesterday in Europe, European Central Bank decision day. Interest rates left on hold, no surprises there. The question was, what would Christine Lagarde have to say? We found out.
On inflation, first of all, I would observe that we are on this disinflationary process and we are making progress. And we are more confident as a result. But we are not sufficiently confident. And we clearly need more evidence, more data.
Well, let's get reaction to that now and find out what happens next. Dr. Stefan Gerlach is chief economist of EFG Bank in Switzerland. He's also a former deputy governor of the Bank of Ireland. So he has been in the room as a policymaker. Spoke to him yesterday from his base in Switzerland. That's where he lives. And he says, as you'll hear now, that he would have acted quicker in cutting rates to boost the European economy.
So I have felt that the European economy was a little bit too weak for me, and I would have been inclined to cut interest rates earlier. But it's certainly true that the economy, the overall euro area economy, has held up. And I think the German economy may be in recession, but the broader euro area, I think, is not in recession. Inflation is high. So I think, in fact, the ECB's governing council has done the right thing, being a little bit hesitant. I've been worried about this, but I think their call has been right so far.
So in terms of the health of the European economy, and if I can be selfish as a business journalist in Dubai and the audience that I have here in the UAE, Europe's such a massive trading partner for us. Europe's such a massive source market for tourism, particularly German, but other countries as well. How are those consumers feeling? Do they have euros in their pocket to come on an expensive economy to a dollar-based destination like the UAE or Qatar or Saudi Arabia?
Well, you know, when you have a recession in an economy, typically it doesn't affect the whole economy. It's the weakest part of the economy that becomes very weak and too weak, if you like. So spending is still there. So I wouldn't, from that perspective, sort of want to exaggerate the consequences of a recession in Europe. There are pockets of Europe then that would have a real difficult time, but not the overall economy. And I mean, the German economy is still a very large economy and consumers have money to spend. So I wouldn't be too concerned from the UAE's perspective. You will still have tourists coming from Europe.
What about the health of corporate Europe? We're all getting familiar with the new acronym, the GRANOLAs, these 11 European stocks, many of them in Switzerland, where you are in, for example, the pharmaceutical industries, not so much tech, of course, in Europe. How healthy or otherwise is corporate Europe, would you say?
I think corporate Europe is surprisingly healthy, in fact. Of course, some industries that are very, very interest sensitive, such as the real estate industry, etc., they are having a tough time. But other industries, export-oriented industries, are doing quite well. The forecast is for economic recovery. So I think, you know, things are picking up from here. So I wouldn't be, also in that regard, I wouldn't be too concerned. The risk is, of course, that if the massive interest rate increases that we have seen in the US and in Europe, if they were to generate a serious recession, of which there is no sign right now, but if something were to go wrong, if you had some, for instance, major financial intermediary going belly up or something like that, then the situation could turn much worse very rapidly. But in the absence of that, I think things look reasonably good, in fact.
Gold prices have been at a record high this week. Of course, Bitcoin also hitting a record high this week. I was following you on X and looking at some of your comments, particularly on cryptocurrencies, and making a historical reference to private banknotes. Very briefly, could you share your thoughts on cryptos and this historical precedent, perhaps?
Of course. So cryptos is a private form of currency. And we had a lot of private currencies in the 19th century, banknotes. Banks were issuing banknotes. And in many cases, this generated very serious problems that are similar to the problems we see with crypto now, where various types of fraud, bankruptcies, they fluctuated a lot in value from one day to the next and so on. And as a consequence of that, in a number of countries, there was pressure for the government to take over the issuing of banknotes. And in fact, this was one big driver for the establishment of the Swiss National Bank in 1907. The country needed a banknote that was a stable value and that was accepted everywhere across Switzerland. And I think this is going to be the big driver for central banks to get into the digital currency, to make sure there is something good out there that's not subject to some of these problems private currencies historically have been riddled with.
Finally, interested to get your take on what's happening in the Middle East economies, in particular the Gulf economies, where we are at the moment. Very strong, particularly non-oil growth for the likes of the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia. Of course, your bank, EFG, has a significant presence in Dubai, the UAE, yes, and the wider region. When you look at oil prices, when you look at these economies, what do you see going forward?
Well, these economies are fundamentally very strong. I mean, historically, they've been very much tied to oil and so on. But they're becoming much more diversified economies. International politics is the thing. If we can avoid that, I think things look fundamentally very good. These economies are tied to the US dollar. The Fed has raised interest rates by 525 basis points. Nevertheless, these economies are doing well. And of course, when the Fed starts to cut rates, this will give them a bit of wind in their backs, I think.
Dr. Stefan Gerlach, he is chief economist at EFG Bank, talking to me late last night from Switzerland on the back of that decision by the European Central Bank to keep interest rates on hold. The markets now expect the first rate cut in Europe to come in June.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
March the 8th is International Women's Day, and we are looking at that issue by looking at the issue of women in business in the Middle East, because we are the Business Breakfast. Delighted to be joined in the studio by Heather Henyon, the founding partner of Mindshift Capital. Heather, good morning. Thanks very much indeed for being with us.
Good morning, Richard. Thanks for having me.
So you are a seasoned venture capitalist, fund manager, investor, financier, call it what you will. And your research suggests that there is a problem. And that problem is not enough money is going to all female-founded companies. Globally, just 2% of venture capital goes to all female-founded companies. Here in the Middle East and North Africa, it's even worse, just 0.5%. Put some flesh on the bones. What are we seeing?
Right. No, thanks, Richard. Yeah, it's been a problem for the last at least 10 years in terms of data that we've been tracking. But we also see it as a massive opportunity. We have been inundated with pipeline in terms of companies that are raising capital. We just need more capital that targets those female founders. And that's basically what Mindshift does. You know, we're looking for these kinds of companies where there's at least one female founder or co-founder. Everything else is the same in terms of, you know, top in class venture capital investments. We just need much more capital that exclusively or intentionally targets these female founders, because unfortunately it's the other side of the table that needs to be fixed as well, the investor side, where less than 10% of partners at venture capital funds in the U.S. are women. In the region, we don't have the data, but it's much lower than that. So that's where I think we need to focus our intention, is how do we get more capital into the ecosystem via the VCs who are actually looking for these kinds of businesses that target or include women.
It reminds me of the famous Sheryl Sandberg TED Talk from more than a decade ago, Lean In Now, where she talks about earlier on in her career, and I'm sure you've seen the talk, where she talks about going to raise funding at a venture capital office and asking where the restroom was, and nobody knew where the women's restroom was because they saw so few women there trying to either raise or indeed deploy funds in that industry. Okay, well, let's look at this differently. Let's look at the global figure. If only 2% of funds are going to all female-founded companies, let's flip it around. What percentage of companies looking for funds are all female-funded? Is it 50-50? Presumably some are all male, some are all female. Many will be a mix of both. But what percentage of companies looking for funds are all female-funded?
Yeah, I mean, in the U.S., for example, it's anywhere from 20 to 30%. In the region, I actually think it's much higher than that, which isn't what most people expect. When I tell people this in New York at like a cocktail party, this isn't the perception they have of the Middle East, that there are a lot of women entrepreneurs here. I think actually from, you know, now doing this for 10 years, I started the first Women's Angel Investor Group literally 10 years ago in 2014. And from our experience and just the 200 companies that I've been involved in investing in and with Dubai Angel Investors, Cairo Angels, all of these other groups, I actually think it's closer to 40% of the companies in the region have at least one female founder or co-founder. So that doesn't mean that they're exclusively women-led, but they've got a mix of maybe gender diversity, which is what we see in our portfolio as well at Mindshift. Half our companies have male and female founders or mixed teams, and then the other half are all female founding teams. So again, if you look at the spread, even if it's, let's say, 20%, and then, you know, in the region, less than 1% of the capital is going, there's a massive opportunity for funds like ours to be targeting these founders. So how do we get more capital into the investment side to deploy and move the needle on the founder side?
It would be remiss of me at this point not to mention that my wife is the founder of an all-female-led company here in Dubai that's doing very well. So good
Great,
morning.
Great, awesome. And that's the other thing, Richard. You probably know this firsthand, but this is why we're doing it. We're not a charity. We're not a nonprofit. We're not a subsidy-driven fund. We're out for financial returns. So we know that women outperform. You know, they raise less capital, but they're more capital efficient. They spend a lot less. And they actually generate revenue faster, which in today's market and today's economy is a massive differentiation for female founders.
Right. Well, let's look at some examples. You've invested in 18 companies led by 24 female founders, and you've got rich doing it, which frankly...
well,
the
not
business...
yet. On paper, but yeah, it's coming.
And that's what we're all about on The Business Breakfast. Let's talk about some of them. A couple of examples. Locally, a company called Kids, which is a platform for booking entertainment. Tell us about that company and the prospects.
Yeah, so Kids is awesome. They're started by three women who have been living in the region for a number of years. All very successful operators, come out of the business world, worked at corporates like Shell, you know, big companies. One ran M&A. So these are, you know, serious business women. They started this company because they had children. They didn't have a way to access, you know, easily all the entertainment offers that were on hand that we all look for when we're in Dubai and on the weekend and after school and all of the different areas out there. They've actually struggled to raise capital. We've invested now in three funding rounds. We have a board seat. We're the only investor on the board. But they've done really, really well. They're at, you know, cash flow positive. 95% of their revenue is coming out of the Saudi market. They're the first mover. So, I mean, they're just ready to explode. They've literally witnessed that hockey stick growth over the last 12 months. COVID was rough for them, but, you know, after that, they're really just phenomenal and spectacular. So I would encourage all investors to take a hard look at this company because I think they're on to something and going somewhere.
What about globally? You've had spent a lot of time in North America doing this. Mm-hmm. One international company you've invested in is Motivo. Tell us about the business success story.
Right. So Motivo started in 2020, literally right before COVID was starting. Started by a trained clinician, a psychologist named Rachel McRickard. And she basically was trying to create a platform that licensed therapists, because in the U.S. they have requirements around the supervisory hours in order to become a practicing therapist. Of course, COVID happened. There was this massive, you know, mental health crisis that basically affected the whole world. So this huge wait list for therapists. And she was positioned to be in the role of licensing these therapists. Since then, you know, they've got into the insurers market, payers. They're basically building the mental wellness and mental health platform. Last year, doubled revenues, B2B customers, so doing really, really well, and we're very bullish on them.
30 seconds left. If there are female entrepreneurs listening to this, we've got one in the green room, Kelly Lundberg, as well, looking to raise money. What's your message to them?
Yeah, do it. I mean, talk to as many people as you can, build relationships early, reach out to us at Mindshift. We're happy to talk and keep going, keep growing, stay strong, and, you know, go out, collect the no's, because when you get the no's, you'll get a few yeses as well. So thank you.
Heather Henyon, really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much indeed for joining us on March the 8th, International Women's Day. Of course, this is an issue 365 days of the year, not just a day. Heather is the founding partner of Mindshift Capital.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.